My name's Lee Campbell. What makes me qualified to teach about this? Well, I've been married 29 years in a week or two. I've got two children, one's 20 and one's 14. I've done many things wrong. We learn from our mistakes. I think the older you get, the more you look back at your behavior toward your children with some regrets. So it's time to reflect. I think also professionally, my training is in neuroscience. My PhD is in neuroanatomy and neuroscience. And more and more, we find this sort of fusion between what's going on in the neurosciences with brain development and what goes on in psychology. And they kind of play off of each other. And I've tried to ruthlessly hack out too many science references because you're here to learn practical things, but there'll be a few science references, so don't be afraid. Also, personally, I'm someone who, I'll define this in a little while, but I'm someone who, as an adult, was sort of shame-prone, felt shame easily, frequently, and intensely. And we'll talk a little bit about how this happens. But because of that, we had a personal interest in this topic of shame. And as someone who's a Christian, I'm speaking today from a Christian perspective, I kept running across passages that would say things like, God speaking and saying, on the day you stand before me, you will not be ashamed because of the wrong things you've done against me. And I thought, how could that be? It seemed impossible. On the one hand, God in this text is not saying, don't worry about it, it's no big deal. He's saying, this is wrong. This is something wrong you did against me. But he said, you won't feel shame. And I came to understand that the purpose of Christ being here on earth was to deal with guilt for having done wrong, but also the shame from having done wrong. And so I'm speaking from a Christian perspective as well as a neuroscience perspective as well as a parenting perspective, but also in my profession, I have for many years now been a pastoral counselor here at Xenos, and I keep running across people who come in, college age and even much older people, and the crux of their problem is the amount of shame they carry with them. And so, for all of these reasons, I have become very, very interested in this topic. I think when we talk about parenting and we talk about shame, it's important to define our terms. Because this word shame is used in a variety of ways. The term guilt is used in a variety of ways. Sometimes they're treated the same. If you went out and surveyed people and asked them questions, what's shame? They would have a description, but the descriptions would be all over the map. Sigmund Freud talked about guilt complexes, but as you look at his literature and his writings, he's actually describing shame rather than guilt. And so I just want to define my terms. Other people may have different definitions, but when I talk about shame, this is what I mean when I say it. When I talk about guilt, this is what I mean when I say it. So shame is the negative feeling of being exposed and found lacking by another. In fact, our word shame comes from a European word, chem, which means to cover, right? Because when people feel shame, they cover, they make themselves small. Have you ever seen someone who's shamed? Have you been shamed yourself? You make yourself small. You tend to look down and to the left, or to the right, rather. And this is sort of almost a universal reflex that people have when they feel shame, this need to cover, to hide, to withdraw. Everyone feels shame. Guilt, the way I'm going to use the word guilt, it's the negative feeling of having done something wrong to another. And I want you to notice this one phrase in each of these. Shame is found wanting by another, and with guilt, it's something that you've done wrong to another. the orientation of shame and guilt are different. The orientation of guilt is toward the offended party. I'm concerned about you because I wronged you. The focus of shame is the sense of being evaluated by another. The focus of shame is self. In fact, the real damaging part of shame is it triggers intense self-focus and self-attention. Now, I'm going to use another series of terms that I want to distinguish from shame and guilt. One is this idea of being shame-prone. And what I'm hoping to accomplish today is to maybe at least have you begin thinking about how to not help your child become shame-prone. Because shame-proneness is not correlated with better moral behavior. And shame-proneness is correlated with lots of mental health problems. A shame-prone person is someone who has frequent and intense shame responses. We'll talk about the causes of this in just a second. Someone who's guilt-prone is someone who has guilt responses when they do something wrong. And you may notice or have this gut feeling like, wow, the shame-proneness sounds bad, guilt-proneness sounds good. That's exactly how I'm using it. So when I say someone's guilt-prone, I mean they have a healthy conscience. I know it sounds bad to say guilt-prone, but a guilt-prone person is someone who is aware of the negative impact they have on others, and they try to repair the problem. Now, you might think, well, aren't there people that have problems with guilt? Some people describe this as having an overly sensitive conscience or an overly scrupulous, I wasn't sure I'd be able to say that, let me say it again, overly scrupulous conscience. The reason I'm not going to go in that direction is because people who have an overly scrupulous conscience may in fact be shame-prone. They may be more attentive to their behavior because they're more afraid of being shamed. And I think also some people have a defense mechanism, and this is it. You are so hard on yourself in front of other people, it keeps them from criticizing you, right? You hit yourself in the face so no one else will hit you in the face. It's a defense mechanism. And so I've heard people report to me that they have an overly scrupulous conscience, but I know them to be people that are highly defensive and unwilling ever to be criticized. So this isn't a problem with being guilt-prone. This is a problem with actually being shame-prone and trying to avoid it. So I'm going to use then the term guilt-prone. Well, see, that was my lead into this big talk I already gave you. So this is developing conscience. So what I'm hoping we can start to do today is to learn how to develop a good moral center in your child, a conscience, and how to keep them from feeling overly attached to the opinions of other people, shame prone. What causes these secondary emotions? Now, why am I calling these secondary emotions? Well, there are primary emotions that children have from birth. Sadness, happiness, fear, anger. These are primary emotions. They're hardwired into our brainstem and midbrain. There you go. There's a science term. Secondary emotions develop around the age 2.5. And these develop around this age because it's around this age children become self-conscious, self-aware. How do we know this? Well, there were experiments done with monkeys to see if they were self-conscious. They would put a little dot of paint on the monkey's nose and put the monkey in front of a mirror. And if the monkey would reach up and touch the mirror, then they weren't aware the dot was on their nose. Well, they did the same thing to babies. And to put a baby in front of a mirror with a dot of paint, and they're grabbing the mirror. But at around 2.5, they start touching their nose. They become aware, this thing I'm seeing here is on me. And so it's around this time they begin to develop secondary emotions that are related to becoming aware of themselves. And so these are, we'll talk about maybe some of these self-conscious emotions, but we'll talk about causes first. What causes secondary emotions? Well, one thing that's involved in causing secondary emotions, particularly shame, is attachment. Attachment is something that happens if you're parenting well, you help your child to attach to you. So if you saw your child looking like that, what would you do? Hopefully you wouldn't do this. This would actually not cause attachment. It would cause the opposite of attachment. Hopefully you would do something like this, right? Nurturing causes attachment. What's going on here? Notice her eye contact. Notice her lips. She's making vocalizations. She's touching, snuggling, making noises, maybe singing. Often there's rhythmic movement. Now this is really important for kids that have been abused. To help them out of their abuse is to start helping them by helping them move rhythmically when they're anxious. Most abused kids go into school in a high level of panic, and they're unable, their cortex does not work in that situation, just like yours wouldn't work. You become dumb when you're panicky. It's just the way, it's good for survival. You don't need your cortex to get involved when you're in danger. You need reflexes. You need to move fast. And so what is interesting with these children, though, who've been abused, is that if you rock them in a certain rhythm, it calms them. Guess what the rhythm is? The maternal heartbeat. That's the rhythm. And so if mom was a marathon runner, it's very slow. If mom is sort of as a tense person, it may be more like this, right? But most people, if you put them in a rocking chair, will begin to rock at the rhythm of their mom's heartbeat. Well, of course, as you're developing, this heartbeat is the sound you hear all through development. And so these kinds of things cause attachment. Looks like dad discovered why that baby was upset, right? So when the baby's not feeling well, when the baby's hungry, when the baby's uncomfortable in some way, when the baby's frightened, these sort of consistent, predictable, rhythmic interactions that are high touch, high visual, soft, nurturing sounds, these kinds of interactions will cause the child to attach to their caregiver or caregivers. So attachment is very important for developing secondary emotions. Children who are raised in an environment where they do not attach become shameless, sociopathic. A sociopathic person can do great harm to someone and their pulse rate will not go up. They feel nothing for another person. And so, you're all here. I'm sure you're all great at helping your child to attach. But attachment's very important. We don't want children to be shameless. Shamelessness suggests an inability to connect with other people. So attachment's very important. Another thing that plays a role in secondary emotions is self-awareness. I mentioned to you around 2.5, children become more self-aware. It's not like an on switch. There's a progress. But around this time, actually even earlier than this, there's the development of neurons in the brain that are called mirror neurons. Mirror neurons aren't in one location. They're in many locations. You may or may not know that different locations in the brain serve different functions. And so these different brain locations all have mirror neurons. So if I were up here and I thought, I don't think I brushed my teeth this morning. And I pull out a toothbrush, and I begin brushing my teeth in front of you. The neurons in your brain, mirror neurons in your brain, would begin firing as if you were brushing your teeth. They're mirroring my behavior. And around 1 up to about 8, children begin developing these neurons, and this is plays an important role in connecting with other people and in self-awareness. Anyway, around this time, these secondary emotions begin to develop. For instance, pride and guilt. Pride, I don't mean pride in the negative, immoral sense of someone who's arrogant. I'm using the pride in a very narrow sense of having accomplished something and feeling joy in accomplishing. So you finish your project and you're like, yes, that's pride, good pride. Guilt is a negative feeling associated with failure. I didn't get this done. I did behave in a bad way toward my child. And so guilt and pride are similar. Why did I pair them? Well, they're similar in that they're both specific, aren't they? Both refer to some specific thing that you've done. Either you've accomplished something you wanted to accomplish and you have pride, that's specific, or you've done something you didn't like and you feel guilt, that's also specified. Another set of secondary emotions that develop are hubris and shame. Hubris is an old-fashioned term. If I hadn't already used the word pride to mean something positive, I'd have stuck the word pride here, because pride often is used in place of hubris in our culture. Hubris is an inflated positive view of self. It's a sort of a global positive self-assessment. It's not rooted in any particular behavior. You know, when a kid gets out on the playground and goes, I am the greatest, I'm awesome, I'm really good, I'm smart, I'm smarter than anybody. This is hubris. And this is sort of a generalized positive self-regard. Shame, as we've already noted, is a generalized negative self-regard. Now, can you see a relationship between guilt and shame? If I do something wrong, I feel guilt. And if someone else saw me do it, I feel shame. If I am shame prone, I quickly generalize this to, so let me put it this way. So I get down in an old-fashioned house and I look through a keyhole to see what's in the room. Guilt. And then I hear the floor creaking behind me. Someone is looking at me, looking through the hole. Shame. Right? Guilt and shame. But shame can, for a shame-prone person, shame can also be associated with pride. You accomplish something, now people are looking at you and you feel shame because you're being looked at. I could make anyone here feel shame. All I would have to do is point at you long enough that everyone starts looking at you and you'd begin to feel shame. Why? Because you're being looked at. What do they see? Is there something on my teeth? My hair looks terrible. You know, they see that how weird my nose is. My ears, you know, on one side is lower than the other side. All these things we don't like about ourselves. I'm too fat. You know, now that we're like, people are looking at me and I feel shame. Shame is this sort of global negative self-regard. So hubris and shame are alike in that they're global self-perspectives. Maybe you wouldn't be surprised, but often people are shame-prone, are also hubris-prone. They could feel terrible about themselves, but then they feel like everyone else is worse than them. And so they deal with their shame by shifting over to some sort of empty, vacuous, positive self-regard. Another set of secondary emotions are entitlement and self-pity. Once you become aware of yourself, you might begin to think, I deserve certain things. I deserve this. Parents can feed entitlement by always granting the wishes of their children. If a child never hears no, that child will be an entitled child when they get older. Self-pity is like entitlement. Entitlement is the sense of, I deserve this. Self-pity is sort of, it's a quieter entitlement. It's feeling bad about myself because I didn't get what I deserved. You know, no one called me on my birthday. You know, that's self-pity. entitlement would be, someone better call me on my birthday, right? And so these are similar in that they have a sense of what I deserve that I didn't get or that I should get. So these begin to develop at around 2.5, and they continue to develop. Truthfully, children feel this, these feelings at a very early age, and I need to make something clear. Emotions develop before cognition. Children feel shame before they can process the meaning of shame. Children feel guilt. You've seen your child, a young child, who does something wrong, and they make themselves small, and they look away. But they are unable cognitively to process the feeling they have. Around 8, children begin to be able to process cognitively what they're feeling emotionally, because around that time, their cortex is developed enough that they can process it. And so sometimes we try to help our children with their shame by reasoning with them when they're too young to really reason about it. So it's important to understand that the emotional development precedes the cognitive development. All right. Another thing that's involved in forming secondary emotions is mimicry. I mentioned this to you already, the idea of mirror neurons. Mirror neurons begin to develop around 1. So see this? This is mimicry. Mom sticks out her tongue, baby sticks out her or his tongue in response. This is driven, neurologically, this is driven by these mirror neurons. And when children reach a certain point that they begin to easily mimic their mother or their primary caregiver, then they're at a point in their development where they can begin to develop morally. Because the empathy, the ability to feel for someone else, comes from this learning how to mimic. If someone's sad and the mirror neurons in my brain are firing that would fire if I were sad, then I begin to feel for them. That's what empathy is, to feel for someone. All right. So what causes shame proneness? We're not going to escape shame in this world. If we're social creatures at all, we're going to be concerned about how we're evaluated. The nature of being a social creature is that how you're evaluated matters. And so you're not going to escape shame. We're going to talk about maybe healthy ways to process shame, but the thing that I want you to work with your children on is helping them not to become shame prone. All right. So what causes shame proneness? This tendency to have frequent, intense, and long-lasting shame feelings. Well, you know, many, many things can cause it. Temperament can cause it. As you know, different children have different personalities. This morning, I was watching you drop some of your children off over here, and I noticed about 20% of them walked straight in and didn't even look back. There's experiments that were done with children as toddlers that were regarded longitudinally, that is over time, and they were evaluated for their emotional health later on in life. And what they find is about 20% of children this is the scenario, mom brings their toddler into the room, there's toys in the room and a helper, and mom sits down and the child gets distracted with the toys, and when the child's distracted, mom leaves the room and quietly shuts the door. And for about 20% of the children, they'll look around, they won't see mom. Physiologically, they're stirred up by this, their heart rate goes up, their pupils dilate, their blood pressure increases, but they just keep playing. Mom comes back in the room, and they don't regard her at all. When these children get older, this may be somewhat taught, but it's also hardwired in some people. When they get older as adults, they tend to be avoidant in the way they attach. They feel easily smothered. They have a strong desire to be independent and autonomous. And about 25% of the children in this scenario will completely melt down. they'll scream, they'll cry, they'll throw themselves back on the floor, they'll kick, they'll howl. The helper will try to distract them, and they'll hit the helper in the head with a toy. And mom comes in, and they're like, oh, they're inconsolable, right? And they follow these people into adulthood, and they describe these kinds of people as anxious attachment kinds of people. That is, they just by nature or nurture, it's not clear what, are very anxious about their close relationships. Could you imagine if an anxious attaching person and an avoidant attaching person dated? It's terrible. One researcher had a graduate student, they have to, in the psychology department, they have to do psychological testing throughout their career, and she was evaluated as a normal person, and then she began dating this avoidant person. She was texting him and calling him all the time. He was turning his phone off. He wouldn't respond. He stayed away from her. He got more and more agitated about being around this life-sucking force, because he doesn't like this level of intensity. And she got more and more anxious about, is he going out on me? She would be with him at a party, and she began flirting with other men in order to get him jealous. These are drama queens and kings, right? And so she was tested psychologically during this time and evaluated as having a borderline personality disorder. This made her crazy. She, after this relationship ended, she returned back to normal. About half of the kids in this study are what are called normal. They do what most of your children did. They fuss a little bit when you drop them off, and then someone hands them a toy or takes them off somewhere. Some other child approaches them, maybe some child who's more empathetic, and suddenly they're distracted and they return to normal. Mom returns, and it's sort of like, right? The anxiety returns, but easily soothed. About 50% of the population is like this. This is just, it may be hardwired, it may be nurture, it's not clear, but this is sort of the distribution of attachment in the population. So some people who are, for instance, anxious in their attachment style may be more likely to be shame prone. These tendencies I'm going to continue listing are sort of like, have you ever gone online and taken a stress test? I don't mean an exercise test. I mean a test where, you know, did you lose a job this year? Have you moved? Did you have a child? Was there a divorce? You know, just that you tick off this list of stressors. And when you're all done, they rank how stressed you are. And they'll often say, if you're highly stressed, they'll say, you are going to become sick. Because when you're highly stressed, cortisol is released, which helps in the short term but decreases your immune system's ability to function in the long term, and you get sick. A lot of you are stressed in your child rearing, and you get sick a lot, right? Well, this causes a shame proneness is very similar. I'm going to list a bunch of things after temperament, and there may be contributions from several of these, and together they sort of indicate whether someone's going to be shame prone or not, all right? So, temperament is one. Another is gender. In general, girls tend to be more socially aware than boys. And because they're more socially aware, more socially alert, more socially concerned, they're also more prone to feeling shame. Because how does the group react to me? And, you know, girls are as aggressive as boys. It's just often with girls it tends to be more verbal. That's where they're strong. And ostracism happens in girl groups all the time. Probably some of you were ostracized. And there's this feeling you walk down the hall at school when you're ostracized and your face is red, shame. You don't look around, shame. Right? Boys, it's not entirely clear if this is primarily because of their gender or because of the experiences they have in life. Boys can often shrug off shaming behavior. In schools, typically, teachers are female, and in typically female teachers, they reward girls' behavior, which is much more socially conscious, and they punish boys' behavior, which is much more physical. And probably girls and boys shouldn't even go through school at the same rate, because boys just don't develop emotionally at the same rate. But boys get criticized a lot in school. Have any of you ever been criticized by a boss? No one. Oh, some of you. Have any of you ever been criticized by a boss in front of your coworkers? How does that feel? Your child gets this several times a day. And boys often get it more, and they may learn to shrug it off, or they may learn their peer group may reward them for what their teacher's punishing them for. Like, all right, you made Mrs. Crabapple cry, right? So there's this association between shame, proneness, and gender. Losses that happen in life. Children are by nature egocentric. They think very magically about themselves and how they affect the world. They overvalue the impact they have on the world. So if a parent dies, the child will often feel like they may have had something to do with it. I know someone whose mother died when he was 10, and he said, of cancer, and he said, I know that I didn't kill my mother, but there was always an asterisk there, a sense of maybe I did something that contributed to her death. And so children, because they're egocentric, will often blame themselves for things that happen that are not their fault at all, including losses. Abnormalities. So I've got a short, soft palate. What that meant is when I was a baby and nursing, the milk would come rolling out of my nose. What that meant as a child is my voice was nasally, and I got teased by students and teachers. So I loved science. I was in a science class in high school, and the teacher asked the question, and I put my hand up and I answered the question. He repeated back my answer, like this, and he did this several times. It was around this time I began contemplating suicide. The problem, one mental health problem connected with shame proneness is suicide. In fact, many suicides are tied to shame. And so if the child is dealing with some abnormality, they need help coping with the abnormality if they're stuck with it. We can become shame prone because of the people we're associated with. It could be racial, it could be economic, it could be, you know, any number of things. This one guy who's dealing with shame said, my whole life, I thought I was the most popular guy in school. And then in high school, I realized I was only popular with these kids that everyone else thought was nerdy and stupid. And then he began feeling ashamed because he was associated with these nerdy people. And he withdrew from them, so he didn't have to feel shame anymore. And of course, abuse can cause shame proneness. If a child doesn't attach, then abuse might not cause shame proneness because attachment never occurred. Actually, because attachment might have occurred, abuse can lead to proneness towards shame. It does lead to an You know, if a child is sexually abused, they think they somehow did something to cause that to happen. If a child is physically abused, because they're egocentric, they think they did something to cause that to happen. And frankly, an adult can look back and say, I didn't cause that, and yet in their bones, they still feel like they're shameful. Right? Probably about 20-25% of you have been sexually or physically or verbally abused. So you carry shame with you. And the thing that maybe we can have a little more control over is shaming forms of discipline. So, you know, a good parent is well-meaning. They see bad behavior. They try to correct the bad behavior. But they maybe do it in a way that actually triggers shame instead of guilt. We'll talk about developmentally appropriate times to deal with bad behavior. If my child behaves badly, I want them to feel bad. The question is, how bad do I want them to feel, and how do I want them to feel bad? In what way should they feel bad? Ideally, what I want them to do is feel bad about the behavior, not bad about themselves. I want to try to keep them from generalizing from the particular thing. And so a lot of times when parents, well-meaning parents, are trying to discipline their children, and maybe they're short, they're overwhelmed themselves, they hate this behavior they see. Maybe it's like behavior that was directed at them when they're a kid, so it's a trigger for them. They'll say, "Why did you hit her? You're always hitting her. What's wrong with you?" Right? You see, you've gone from the specific behavior, hitting, to a generalized globalization of what is wrong with you. It's easy to change your mind about hitting. It's hard to change your mind about being a jerk. Right? What do you change when you try to become unjerky? What do you change when you try to become not a loser? And so, I just would encourage you, again, there's developmentally appropriate ways to do this, but not to generalize from a particular behavior to who they are as a person. Who they are as a person, they should have a sense of unconditional, positive regard. Even when they're doing something wrong, you're helping them with the thing they did wrong, but you still hold them in good regard. Easier said than done. Right, because children can just drive you nuts with the frequency of wrong things that they do. But this is at least a goal, to not generalize from the particular behavior. Some parents use forms of humiliation, hoping that by shaming them, it'll inhibit behavior. There is zero correlation between producing shame and behavior change. Zero. Shame... Feeling shame does not cause moral behavior. Feeling guilt causes moral behavior. Feeling you've done a particular thing wrong causes moral behavior. All right. So my mom used a form of discipline, not often, but often enough, where she would, well, for instance, she didn't like how I was eating my dinner one time. She thought I was making too much noise and way too sloppy. So she put my food on the floor and commanded that I eat it with my face like a dog. Since you're eating like a dog, eat like a dog. Well, that's humiliation. I wanted to try tomato juice. You won't like tomato juice. I want to try tomato juice. She poured me a giant glass of tomato juice and made me drink the whole thing. I threw up and then cleaned it up. That's humiliation. Right? So... maybe well-intentioned, I can look back and say there's a lot of things about my mother that are wonderful. She did help us attach. She did provide for us. She was a real go-getter. She was easy to talk with. There's a lot of things about her that were wonderful. This wasn't one of them. And it led to all four of her boys being shame-prone. Disciplining your child in public. Sometimes you have to provide restraints on your child. You're in a store, they're running around, they're pulling stuff off of shelves, and you have to deal with them. But as much as possible, try to discipline them privately. Some parents they'll get very loud about the faults of their child for the audience that they're around. This is humiliation. It's encouraging other people to look at my screwed up kid. It causes shame. Because I have this speech impediment, I began talking more and more quietly as a child, and I started talking out of the side of my mouth, and it was hard for anyone to hear me, and they would say, "What?" And I'd feel more shame, and so I'd get quieter, or I would just stop talking. And so my parents had friends of theirs over and their kids who were my age one time, and I was in the living room playing with these kids, and I heard my mom loudly saying, "He would be easy to understand if he would just open his mouth." Well, as quickly as possible, I escaped to the basement, right? That's using public forms of discipline or correction. Yelling. Ever been yelled at? How do you like it? It is shaming. Maybe you yell back, and so now we're in a yelling match. Recent studies have indicated, maybe this is no surprise to anyone, yelling has no effect on teenage behavior, except to make it worse. Because it's shaming behavior. And this is the one I frankly have to admit I've practiced as a parent, and that's the use of sarcasm. Sarcasm is a sort of a sly way of expressing hostility. Oh, you'd never do that. Right, what am I implying? You always do that. And so, again, I'm using sarcasm, but I'm sort of generalizing about who they are as a person by using sarcastic comments. Oh, everything's about you. What am I saying? You're someone who always feels entitled. How do you change your mind about that? So, you know, to use sarcasm because you see something in particular you don't like, you say something sarcastic, is you, in a sly sort of way, generalizing about who they are as a person. And so, if you were to check through this list, temperament, gender, losses that you've suffered, abnormalities that you have, people you've associated with, abuse you've suffered, shaming forms of discipline, if you were to sort of rank those, you know, and tally them up, you might be like, oh my God, I'm shame prone. But you probably already knew that. Here's a piece of good news. There's no correlation between shame-prone parents and shame-prone children. That is, a shame-prone mother doesn't make her child necessarily shame-prone. Whew. That's a load off, isn't it? However, shame-prone parents can make errors, like my mom lost, her father left when she was young, her mom had a series of men living with her. Some of them were drunks, and her older brothers drove them off with broken bottles. And she had a tumultuous childhood. She came by her shame proneness naturally. She also was disciplined in the same way. She used the same discipline that had been used on her, right? So, yes, it affected me, but she came about it honestly. She came about it because of how she experienced life. We can modify how we discipline our children to produce less shame. Well, I'm really burning up time here. Okay, let's look at some developmental priorities. I hope you can see this, but you have a handout that has the material on it, PowerPoint slides. You might want to flip to that page. I think it says page 2 or 3. I'm not sure where page 2 went. It says page 3. But if you look at page 3, this is what I'm about to show you, this little table with this little tiny writing. So I think developmentally it's good to help your child feel appropriate pride. It's probably going to stimulate your child to have hubris, that general positive self-regard, if you reward them for just being awesome. You're awesome. You get a sticker for everything. It doesn't matter what you do. You're wonderful. You're so smart. You're so beautiful. These general sort of positive things actually don't help much. They can actually play into shame. Because how good can you feel about something that doesn't seem to be even connected with you? And but if they are working hard at something and you admire their hard work, that will really help them have appropriate pride. If they accomplish something and you can find something about what they did that's admirable that you can focus on, we're not talking about flattery where they put together some pile of crap and you go, oh, that's beautiful, right? They spit on it and throw a couple of pieces of paper. Look what I did, Mommy. No, but if they do something well or some part of what they've done is good, notice it and admire it. This helps them develop appropriate pride. Also, you need to help them feel appropriate guilt. If they hit their sibling, then you need to say, you hit her, don't hit her, look at her, she's crying. You're both naming a specific bad behavior and you're trying to evoke empathy at the same time. By having them look at crying sister, there at least some of those mirror neurons will fire in their brain and they'll like, I know what it is to feel this way. And over time, this helps develop appropriate guilt feelings, or a conscience. Specific critique, calling on them to feel empathy. Oh my God, this is terrible. I can see it here. At around age 0 to 1, on the left column, I'm just going to describe what's going on in them emotionally and cognitively. And then on the right, some parenting priorities. So what's going on from 0 to 1 is that they feel primary emotions, happiness, sadness, anger, fear. The infant begins to, because some mirror neurons, especially in the visual cortex, begin to develop, they begin to anticipate what the adult's going to do. And this is important, healthy development. Attachment at this age is critically important. It's the basis for later self-regulation. Self-regulation is the ability to inhibit your own impulses, you know, to hit, to spit, to take something, yank something out of someone's hand. Self-regulation. If a child doesn't attach, they have the inability to self-regulate. Attachment is also really important for developing there's circuitry in the brain that's called reward circuitry. Things can make you feel good. Accomplishing a task can make you feel good. Drinking alcohol can make you feel good. Sex can make you feel good. Having warm contacts with other human beings can make you feel good. Drugs can make you feel good. There are many, many things that can make you feel good that activates this very same reward circuitry. If a child doesn't attach, the number of options they have to feel good are much smaller, and that's why they're more likely to drink and use drugs and get into sexual behavior. By helping them attach, you help them to feel rewarded when they make good emotional connections with other people. So attachment's really important. Around 2 to 3, from 1.5 to 2 to 2.5, self-awareness begins. And with that, the beginning of secondary emotions, children around this age begin to imitate their mothers. Imitation is the beginning of moral development. It's the beginning of other things too, like learning skills and being competent and socially engaging, but it's important for moral development too. So between now and 8, trying to distinguish guilt from shame does not work well. Why? Cognitively, they're not able to reason about what they're feeling. They feel what they're feeling, but they can't reason about what they're feeling. And so saying, you hit Sally, sounds like you hit Sally and you're an awful person. And so now you know your own child. You may find that they're maybe further along here, and or maybe earlier they'll move further along, but natural consequences for negative behaviors is sort of the parenting priority. Natural consequences, I'm sure you're familiar with, a punishment that fits the crime. Rewards for positive behaviors too. You know, rewards, especially rewards that are verbal, help strengthen the attachment to relational interactions in order to feel pleasure. And helping them repair damage, right? Part of feeling guilt is you're focused outward on the person you've hurt and you want to try and fix the problem that you caused. It's outward focused. Shame is inward focused. Makes you want to go and hide and withdraw. It's self-focused. Guilt is outward focused. So if they break something, then you say, all right, you're going to have to pay for this. You know, you pull a jar of jam off the shelf at Kroger and you say, okay, we're going to pay for this. This is what it cost, and when we get home, I'm going to take that money from your piggy bank. Yes. When you break things, you have to pay for them. And so helping them repair damage is really important to helping them develop morally later on. practicing empathy toward them. The best way to get empathy into a child is to have it for them, to feel with them. This is where a lot of times parents mistakenly try to use words, and it's not that helpful. It's better to just not instruct. Don't feel that way. That's unhelpful. Don't think this way. Think this way. Not helpful. It's better just to say, oh, that feels yucky, doesn't it? That's the earliest kind of terminology you can use for shame. Oh, I know that feels bad. So you're feeling with them. By you having empathy toward them, you're helping them develop empathy later toward others. Also, when someone, you know, trips and falls and you go, oh, and you move toward to help that person and they're watching, they see this is normal behavior. They mimic. This is where their morality comes from. They begin. You know, today I saw one kid cry and another walked up and did this, right? Where did they learn this? They learned it from mom or dad or both. 4 and 5, they don't attribute secondary emotions. What do I mean by this? This is a cognitive thing. If you tell them a story and something happens in the story that's morally wrong, and you say, how did they feel? They'll give a primary emotion. They felt angry, they felt sad. They won't give secondary emotions. They feel secondary emotions, they just can't process it cognitively yet. Around 6 and 7, they begin to attribute secondary emotions to protagonists and stories, but mainly if there's a parent present in the story. Your earliest ability to connect guilt with behavior is in front of your parents. And so when a parent is in the story and a child does something wrong, then the child will say, he felt guilty. He felt ashamed. If there's no parent in the story, they'll revert to primary emotions again. He was angry, he was sad, something like that. Around 8, from 8 on, children feel primary and secondary emotions, as all the other ages do, but they are able to attribute secondary emotions to protagonists in stories without a parent being part of it. So at this point, you can now begin to help them distinguish guilt and shame. You can begin in introducing reason to them. You did this thing, this is wrong, look how she feels. Now they're able to distinguish guilt from shame. All right. So developmental priorities. You need to help them manage situational shame. Everyone has shame. Everyone experiences shame. It's not the end of the world. You live in a world where shame things happen. Help them manage it. Help them cope. You know, and the important first step in dealing with shame is admitting you feel it. All the problems that come with shame repression, and there's a paper that describes this in more detail, lead to emotional problems. Shame that is stuffed, not admitted, not dealt with, comes up later as anger, rage, depression, narcissism, suicide. And so it's really important to admit, I feel shame. It's important for you to admit that you feel shame. But the problem, of course, with shame is that it's intensely self-focused. And if you stare at your face in the mirror long enough, you'll see a lot to dislike. Self-focus does not help. You have to admit you feel shame. It's important to specify the shame. What did you feel shame for? Was it something you did wrong? Then that's guilt. Let's find a way to repair the damage. Was it because of what someone said? If you can't specify why you feel shame, you can't help them specify why they feel shame, it's hard to deal with it. Once it's specified, it's a little easier to work with. But ultimately, having admitted and identified what caused the shame, it's important for you as a parent, it's important for your child to redirect their attention somewhere else. If you do this last step without doing the first two steps, this serves to repress shame, and it will come out sideways. And so once you've admitted it and I specified it, it's important to get your attention somewhere else. Turn your attention to a project, a play, activity, turning your attention as an adult to other people and having them, your child, direct their attention to other people. As a Christian, I also direct my attention toward God. I wake up in the morning. This has really helped me as a shame-prone person. I recite the 23rd Psalm almost every morning on my bed. Why? Because it pertains to me, but it's not about me. It's about God, what God is like, what God does. Independent. He has unconditional positive regard for me. And so I think about what he does for me. He guides, he protects, he heals, he leads. And as I think about what he is like, then I think about how this pertains to me. I don't always feel like I am lacking nothing, right? The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. And so I'll go through it again and I'll fight. I'll be like, you say I won't lack for anything because you're my shepherd, but I don't really think that. So I'll fight my way through the same psalm, and then I'll go through it again, and I'll affirm it. Recite it, fight it, affirm it. That's my little device. I'll say, even though I don't feel like you're taking care of me, God, I choose to believe that you will. Right? This helps me to direct my attention outward, because otherwise, when I wake up in the morning, I have imagery of violence toward myself that pops into my head, like being stabbed in the chest. It was a frequent one. Or I'd get up and just want to bang my head into the wall because I'd recall something I'd done that was embarrassing, you know, yesterday or 20 years ago. And so the only way for me to get my attention off myself was to deliberately turn my attention to God. I mean, I would first say, well, okay, this is shame. This is what I'm feeling. This is why I'm feeling it. And then I just turn my attention to God. This helps a lot.